They have given them a principle which, if extended, destroys the value of all literature. Because they reject the statement, ultimately they reject the statement in the advertisement, because it's not factual. Then they reject the best of literature. The same, you know, if that's your criterion of rejection, not being non-factual, then that's what you're stuck with. You wipe out all literature. G&T have not given the schoolboy readers any help in discovering any other criteria of value in literature. Okay? They really haven't taught them anything about style because they didn't have a good thing beside it, and they rejected the piece because it was not factual. From this passage, the schoolboy will learn about literature precisely nothing. What he will learn quickly enough, and perhaps indelibly, is the belief that all emotions aroused by local association are in themselves contrary to reason and contemptible. Okay, read that one again. What the student will learn quickly enough, and perhaps indelibly, in other words, never forget it, is the belief that all emotions aroused by local association, things, places, are in themselves contrary to reason and contemptible. Because you don't want to be involved in contemptible, you know, behavior. And I think because only a bad example, the advertisement, has been given, the student thinks that any statements of emotion aroused by local association are as contemptible and stupid as the advertisement. There would have been a question, see, at least they would have recognized that there was a controversy if they had, something from Wordsworth had been put in there anyway. They'd at least know, wait a minute, that's contemptible, that's not. It's essentially the same thing. Why? And even a 16-year-old kid would say, why? And ask G&T a question, which they would have to go back to their study and think about, okay? But they don't do that. They would have to take a 5-minute break and go into the office and figure it out. Okay. And the student will... Well, I should say, any more questions on that, I guess.
Yeah, I don't see how they could comment on style and be consistent with their own philosophy. I mean, it's not just they can't. The only thing they can attack is the factual stuff, right? Because they can't comment on the style at all because of what they've said about how the feelings are. Nothing seems already to be good or bad. It's just your own feelings.
Yeah.
So they couldn't say anything about the style.
Not to be consistent.
Right. Not to be consistent.
Yeah.
So they had to attack.
Yeah, and they moved on. And they attacked it. They did feel it was necessary to go beyond. I mean, they criticized the way the words were put together. Okay. And they were silly. It's bad writing. This is bad writing. Okay. That's a style statement. Style means the way one puts the words together. What they knew is that wasn't enough. That, you know, that wasn't enough. And then they went on and rejected it because of their earlier assumption. That wasn't enough. Wasn't significant enough. And then they said it's got to be rejected. Let's reject it solidly because it isn't factual.
Well, they don't say it's bad. Lewis
didn't say it. Right. Yeah.
They just tell them not to write them.
Yeah.
So it's Lewis that's making the value judgment.
Yeah.
They don't even make the value judgment.
Yeah.
So they are consistent.
Yeah. Check. I think you're right and I'm wrong on that. I think that's right. I think you're right on that. And then I was wrong, because they really can't. They can't be talking about style at all. And that's why they have to go on and reject it. For some reason they know. And where you can reject it,
he's on the metaphor
somewhere. You can reject it in terms of style. And you can reject it in terms of it not being... You can reject the advertisement in terms of style, and you can reject the advertisement in terms of it not being... Well, not really. You wouldn't. You want to get real in there, but you don't want to get real in terms of factual. You know, because metaphors aren't factual, but they're good analogies anyway. You know, meaningful analogies.
So you're saying that we could reject it, or that someone who has a value system could reject it on the basis of style,
mm-hmm.
and on the basis of a poor use of imagery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they can't.
But they can't, but they know they have to reject it.
They have to reject it.
And so they go to
so
the,
they go to
it's
the
not place. Factual. Okay, is that clear?
One more time.
Okay. All right. Oh boy.
You can reject the advertisement in terms of style, and what was the other one you can reject it in?
Well.
Poor use of imagery?
It is, you know, I can reject the advertisement because it's bad style. G&T really can't do that. Why not? I forgot why not.
Because they don't have a value system. They can't. It's just a matter of feelings.
I don't know if we want to go that far yet, because they haven't done that yet.
Yeah,
they haven't gone that. He will talk about that later, but they don't do that.
Couldn't they not say bad style? Because bad is a... Even if you say that word, you got to have a value system, right? To say it's bad style, you have to have... Isn't that... That's a value term.
Yeah. I want to know why Lewis says that, why he's talking about this.
Well, we could go back to that quote... where they add, this confusion is continually present in language as we use it. We appear to be saying something very important about something, and actually we are only saying something about our own feelings. Now then, doesn't that tie into, they're trying to say something about the ad. They can't really say anything about the ad because they end up saying something about their own feelings. So they can't criticize the style or the imagery. Because all they're talking about is their feelings.
That makes sense
mm-hmm.
to me, what you're saying. Yeah, they can't attack it in terms of style, which Lewis could do.
Right.
Okay.
And he does.
But they can't, because which he does do by saying it's a bad bit of writing. Mm-hmm. And they can't, because that would cause them to meet making...
Because the style is all words and feelings, right?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
That they would have to make value certain emotional responses to that place more than others.
Mm-hmm.
And that, by their system, they can't do that. Yet they know it's bad.
And they know they have to say it's bad.
Yeah.
To get the book published.
Well, yeah. They know it's bad. They are moved. That's that sense of that. However, they don't stop there. They know that they have to reject the ad. A rejection of the ad is necessary. And then they find, what they're saying is not factual. And that is the criterion for rejecting the ad. And with that as your criterion for rejecting statements of emotions aroused by local association, Wordsworth goes out the window, Johnson goes out the window, you know, all poetry goes out the window. A great deal of what has been, what is thought to be great literature goes out the window. And it isn't they that is saying that style is the criterion of value. Lewis is saying that style is a criterion of value. That'll teach me for taking down footnotes. I've gone through, I have a book by Carol, that a copy of Great Divorce, that, or The Abolition of Man, that that is was Carol's, Carol Henderly's, back in the back when it first came out. And he read it and got excited about it and gave it to Howard Hong. Howard Hong read it and he wrote down, and so I've got some footnotes in here that are HH, and I've got HH beside it. They make style the criterion of value. Now I'm going to go check, because I don't think he made the mistake. Sure, he didn't make the mistake. When I copied the footnote down, I bet you his note was style the criterion of value. And I said, well, let's see. Well, they make style the criterion of value. Let me check. I'll check that for you. I'd doubt very seriously if Howard would make that kind of an error. I don't doubt whether Grauber would. But anyway, is that perfectly muddied? Is the water perfectly muddied on that point? No, is that clear? Is it? No? Why they can't?
I don't understand the whole thing.
Okay, where, at what point?
Well, the part we're talking about now, about the advertising.
Okay, that's on page 17. Do you lose it at what point?
How does it connect?
Okay, it doesn't. It's a digression. It's a digression. Okay? Did you follow it up to there? Okay. Pretty much. Pretty much.
Sublimely.
Okay. Okay, he says, before considering the philosophical credentials of the position which G and T have adopted about value, before he does that, which would follow right from where he was before, I would like to show its practical results on their own educational procedure. The practical results of the position that they have adopted on value, that all values are emotional projections of the self, okay? And the effect that has on their teaching. Because they believe that, when they deal with a piece of an advertisement like that, okay, that is silly. Okay.
In this part, as I see it, they're saying that in describing things or putting values on things, they it's coming from something they feel inside, and it's not something that is a result of seeing, like the waterfall. It's not a result of seeing the waterfall.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that they feel inside already. But
yeah.
That doesn't work.
Okay, but G and T are saying that when a person says, that's beautiful scenery, okay, go see the beautiful scenery, the scenery really isn't beautiful. The person who says, hey, that's beautiful scenery, is really making a statement only about his feelings, not about the scenery at all. No, it doesn't. That's what G and T believe, though. Lewis is saying, too, that isn't right. See, G and T have said that when I make a statement like the waterfall is sublime, I'm only talking about my feelings. I'm not talking about the waterfall. Is that what doesn't make sense, that position?
Yeah.
Good. You agree with Lewis, okay? But G and T have said that, and that affects the way they teach, okay? And now this digression, instead of showing the philosophical credentials of the position that G and T have, what kind of support they have for saying what they've said, before talking about that, he wants to show the practical effect on the way they teach. So they take an example that you might find in a book. There's an advertisement. It's bad. Okay? Now they want to reject it. How they go about rejecting it? They can't reject it because of style. The way it's said. Okay? They don't even think of putting Wordsworth alongside. They know they have to reject it because it stinks, and so they tell their students that reject it because it's not factual. And if you make statements about places that aren't factual, you're silly as that advertisement. See? Now, that's all they thought of to say about that advertisement because of the assumption that they've made earlier that a statement about an emotion, a statement I make when my emotions are aroused by a place or a thing like a waterfall doesn't have anything to do with a waterfall. Just my feelings. Mm.
Well, they don't say it's just silly though, either.
Well, that's the purpose of it, though.
Yeah.
He'll go on and talk about
it. Inoculate the pupils in
yeah.
Learning.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't say what they say.
They know they have to protect them from it, okay?
Yeah.
And Lewis almost says that they're, you know, they're well-meaning. Okay? They know they have to protect them from it. And so they say, how are we going to protect them from it? How are we going to keep them from responding to that? Oh, it's not factual, and therefore reject it. They never realize that they've thrown all the literature out the window. If you reject that advertisement on the grounds it's not factual, you reject all metaphor, you reject all the best literature, okay?
Yeah.
But they didn't even think of that because they'd already, in a sense, ruled. Well, they'd ruled it out. And because they only showed the ad, it's not only not reasonable, it's contemptible, because the ad was contemptible. And the kids will say, oh, isn't that silly? And you will not want to be caught responding emotionally to place or thing or whatever. Okay, now that's back to, what was it, Gretchen, or what you guys said? Somebody over here said something.
No, just
okay. I can't remember what it was either. Okay, now the student, then Lewis says, will have no notion that there are two ways of being immune to such an advertisement. The advertisement falls equally flat on those who are above it and those who are below it. On a man, isn't that nice? Yeah, those are above it and then those who are below it, you know. The man of real sensibility, and on the mere trousered ape, who has never been able to conceive of the Atlantic as anything more than so many million tons of cold salt water. And nice.
That's great.
The trousered ape. And there's a book about Lewis's called The Trousered Apes, and I've got a copy of it. I haven't read it yet, but it looks like it'll be fun, and it takes off on this image. Okay. There are two men to whom we offer in vain a false leading article on patriotism and honor. One is the coward, and the other is the honorable and patriotic man. Okay? A false article on patriotism and honor will not be heard by the coward, and will not be heard by the honorable and patriotic man. None of this is brought before the schoolboy's mind. On the contrary, he is encouraged to reject the lure of the Western Ocean, on the very dangerous ground that in so doing he will prove himself a knowing fellow who can't be bubbled out of his cage. Okay? He will be encouraged to reject the lure of the Western Ocean on the very dangerous ground that in so doing he will prove himself to be a knowing fellow who can't be bubbled out of his cage. You know, ha ha. And you know, in drama you have comic relief, and you say something funny, and then you hit something heavy right after it, you know? Gaius and Titius, while teaching him nothing about letters, have cut out of his soul, long before he is old enough to choose, the possibility of having certain experiences which thinkers of more authority than they have held to be generous, fruitful, and humane. Bang, okay? Here he comes again. This thing that seems trivial. And then he says, makes this huge claim. As he made the claim that it's going to have effect on the theology and ethics and politics, now he says that simple thing that they did cut out part of the kid's soul. He's making big claims as to the importance of this question. We got to see if it's, you've got to ask, is he going to pull it off? Is it so?
Question,
yeah.
About those two men he's talking about, you know, the trouser days.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Man of and the article on Patriots, is it sort of, what came to mind was the story that you've been telling about you're being rejected from helping the civil rights movement because
yeah.
you think too much, or you think too well, you care too much about the truth.
Yeah.
So then, does this fit there, that like a movement will not appeal to the man who cares for the truth, or the man who doesn't, the trouser ape who doesn't want to get involved, who's
okay.
very content.
The connection would be that the two people that wouldn't listen to the propaganda of a movement,
yeah.
say of the, okay, let's take the women's movement. The two women who wouldn't be moved by propaganda aspects of certain things in the women's movement will be the woman who is has a significantly developed sensibility, and the woman who thinks that it's God's will that she be pregnant, barefoot, and what is it?
Mm-hmm.
What's the phrase? What is it? Pregnant and barefoot? Is that?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a thing.
I think it's in the kitchen.
Well, that's the German. That's the German one. It's Kirche, Kuchen, and Kinder. That's church, cooking, and kids. That's the Kirche, Kuchen, and Kinder. In other words, a dressed ape. I mean, who hasn't really thought about much about, you know, a female ape who hasn't much, you know, thought about the situation at all. A thoughtless person and a thoughtful person are not going to be moved by propaganda.
Okay, or like...
Very thoughtful.
Reflective.
Person. Yeah, very reflective person.
And non-reflective.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks.
Yeah. Okay. Everybody thinks, but not everybody has thoughts. Okay.
Okay.
Thoughts
so
demand a certain
of,
coherence.
That kind of ties in.
Yeah, I think so.
Understand.
I think so.
I was having a hard time with his example there on patriotism and honor.
Yeah. Okay, well, Uncle Sam wants you. That's not a, you know, a real patriot is not going to get all excited about going out because of that. If he goes, he goes. But he isn't going to go because of the advertisement.
Right.
And a coward won't go because of an advertisement either. Okay. Now, okay, why does he say G&T taught him nothing about letters, which he hasn't really, but G&T have cut out of the child's soul, the student's soul, long before he's old enough to choose. He doesn't know that there's a choice, really. They don't even tell him there's a choice, or there's an issue, or that it's an unsettled question. They just tell him that this is the way it is. They cut out of his soul the possibility of having certain kinds of experiences. You're not a knowing fellow if you respond with emotion to these types of situations. So you rob from the child something that is important, at least Lewis is going to say, in developing or in the growth of the soul. You'll keep that away from him. And then he talks about animals. I don't know how much we have to talk about that. The second book, getting involved in that, unless you have a certain questions. Except that there, you become your stupid person for caring about, you know, animals. Okay, it's silly to have feelings that only humans should have toward animals. And you're silly and unknowing and everything, and so you guard yourself. Whenever you find yourself caring, you say, oh, that's silly, that's just an animal, see? That's merely an animal. And that's his, I think, his use on this second one.
Mm-hmm.
On Orbelius. Okay. Then he emphasizes again that second thing on page 22. He says, a man who really knows horses and loves them, or are there two classes of men who are respectively above and below the danger of such riding? The man who really knows horses and really loves them, not with an anthropomorphic illusions, but with ordinate love. And the irredeemable urban blockhead to whom a horse is merely an old-fashioned means of transport. Some pleasure in their own ponies and dogs they will have lost, the child. And having lost that, something's taken away from them, their soul. Some incentive to cruelty or neglect they will have received. It doesn't matter. They're just. Some pleasure in their own knowingness will have entered their minds. Very true about students, you know. Well, I won't be a dummy like that. I don't care. You know, why, I'll not get caught making that mistake. Some pleasure in their own knowingness will have entered their minds. That is their day's lesson in English. Though of English they have learned nothing. Another little portion of the human heritage has been quietly taken away from them before they were old enough to understand, and they will never even know that there was a question about any of that stuff. Just what you say about animals is going to affect other people, especially if you're older than they are, and if people think you're neat. They think you're neat, little brothers and sisters. It only takes a year younger. If you're looked up to in any way, what you say about horses is going to make a difference. Because although you're no authority, you don't even think of yourself as an authority. In someone's cosmos, you're the authority. See? In someone's world, you are, you know, giving them, telling them what is so. And you get scared about that. And that's just on horses. And I think that link is clear, isn't it? It's just, okay, just teach a guy an attitude toward animals. And it involves these things. Some pleasure is robbed from them, which they have to find elsewhere. Manufacture elsewhere. Because a natural pleasure has been taken away. And then they got to find it, make up for that somewhere else and do something else. Okay? And probably manufacture, instead of pleasure, they'll manufacture excitement. Some pleasure in their own knowingness will have entered their minds. You know, they start to feel like above it. You know, this sort of second-rate thinking. Some incentive to cruelty and neglect they will have received. You start getting used to thinking of animal as a mere. A mere animal, it doesn't make that much difference. And all those things are related. Now, one thing that I have to, two things to bring out there. Ordinate love, what's that? Implication. What's the implication of the two words, ordinate love? And this is the last paragraph, I think, for tonight.
A regular love, a standard?
Standard love, normal love, Not normal, not the standard.
Not innate.
Ordinate. Geometry, people. On graphs in algebra, ordinate. Coordinates, ordinate.
It's one of your axes.
Well, that's a different. I'm sorry, I misled you on that, but ordinate. What is the misled you on geometry? Got two dictionaries here.
Line applied in an ordinary manner.
Line applied in an ordinary manner.
This one. Okay.
It doesn't.
Cartesian coordinates.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's coordinates. It says compare abscissa.
let me see it. Is it ordinate?
It's on the
right column of the left-hand
page. Right column of left-hand page, ordinate. Ordinate. This is not right. Okay, let's go. Here's a crazy thing. I bet you we'll find it under inordinate. Okay, your use on of inordinate. How do you use inordinate? That is inordinate. What is? Give me a sentence. Can you?
Inappropriate.
Inappropriate. What?
I was just making a substitution.
Yeah.
Well, inappropriate love in this case would be the anthropomorphic illusions.
With him, reasonable limits.
Okay, it says in here, yeah. Exceeding reasonable limits.
That's inordinate would be.
Exceeding, yeah, inordinate is.
Within reasonable.
Not just within reasonable limits, but right up to the limit, ordinate love. I mean, there is a certain kind of love that is suitable. Okay? Not with anthropomorphic illusions, but with ordinate love, the kind of love to go to the... There is a kind of love to go to a horse, to a dog. Okay? This is a concept that he's going to be talking about in the Four Loves, but a proper love.
Well, appropriate then is a good word.
Mm-hmm, that's what I, yeah. That's why I scared you by pointing at you like that. Cause you to forget everything you had in mind. Okay. If somebody, you know, I should, you know. Somebody asks you a hard question, you know, you go, what?
Die, forget.
Okay, with ordinate love. All right, a man who really knows horses and really loves them, not with with illusions, you know, or with fetishes, but with an ordinate love. There is a proper, okay, what is implied? There is a proper love. Okay.
Ordered.
Now, I don't want you to answer that right now, but what are some more implications there? That there is a proper love, that there is a right love for this. Well, we can make a connection back. Is there perhaps a right way to respond to a waterfall? Okay. Now, the urban blockhead, the ape in pants, those are nice. Okay, human heritage. Okay, another little portion of the human heritage has been quietly taken from them before they were old enough to understand. Human heritage implies what?
There's tradition?
No. Okay, human heritage, there's something of, that the implication is that there is something. The human heritage is valuable. Now something has been taken away. A little portion of the human heritage has been quietly taken away from them. It's sort of back there on the soul business.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the soul has been taken away.
Mm-hmm.
The heritage of... Well, what am I trying to go at? They will be kept from learning something about what it is to be human. Now, is that implied by human heritage? In that statement on human heritage? They're being kept from learning something about what it is to be human. They won't learn that. Okay, now what does that imply? I may have left out a step in the implication, but you can usually say, okay, that implies that, and then that implies that, and then that implies that, and you keep moving back. And I may have skipped one, but okay, human heritage implies that there is kept away from them. They, something about what it is to be human, they will not learn. That implies...
That there's something to learn about being human.
Something to learn about being human, that implies we... What? being human is something we learn. That implies being human, and he implies being human is something that we need to learn. It is valuable to learn to be human, and that implies being human is better than other than and better than being natural. We don't naturally, we aren't naturally human. Okay? We aren't, being human is better than being that, huh? We aren't naturally human. Human is something we learn.
We learned
to be okay, now that's what he's, isn't that what he's implying? Homo sapiens. And the implication here is human is something that we can learn to be. And that implies that, tip it over, that, we can be less than human, okay?
Can you say for clarification, like, whole person? Not necessarily meaning human?
I wouldn't want to go to whole person on that, I guess, right now. I wouldn't. But what, let me just say real quicker and without running all the implications. This is okay, on human heritage, let a ticker go off in your head. What lies behind that is the implication that being human is something we learn. Being, and the implication that being human is better than being natural. And a number of the other things that we said, that it's more valuable to be human than to be natural. In some ways, becoming human is going to be an artificial process by being opposed to natural. The implication that we, that process should not be rejected because it isn't automatic. And does that explain anything about why he uses the title Abolition of Man? Abolition of Man. And then something like Carol has said, you know, when we say we're only human, we mean we're less than human. You know. But that being human is something that we learn. Is something that that we can learn and that we may not learn. You know, we can learn it to be human. Okay? And we may not, according to what happens to us, what we're told, so forth. Okay, then makes us ask the question, what is it to be human? To have come out, you know, to have been born? Or is it something else?
Is that one of the, that sounds like one of the three basic questions.
Yeah.
What is
it? Mm-hmm. But that's actually a fourth question. I wasn't referring to those three. There are three others.
Uh-oh.
Okay. I should go just a little bit more, but it isn't going to be far. Just down to one word. I have, to 22, I have hitherto been assuming that such teachers as G and T do not fully realize what they are doing, and do not intend the far-reaching consequences it will actually have. And he's saying they don't intend that. They're well-meaning. They don't intend that. But that there are far-reaching consequences which involve cutting souls out of kids, robbing kids of the possibility to be human, which is an implication, and that the consequences are going to have dire effects on these students' ethics, theology, and politics. Okay? That's what he's saying. There is, of course, another possibility. What I have called, presuming on their concurrence in a certain traditional system of values, the trousered ape and the urban blockhead may be precisely the kind of man they really wish to produce. I've been assuming that they were just didn't know what they were doing. But they may be wishing to have produce. Okay, that's the word. What is it produce? Do I produce? I mean, I'm a teacher. Do I produce people?
Production. No, it reminds me of factory.
No.
And
but can one produce people? Manufacture is the word, Carla. Yeah, manufacture, produce. Is it possible to manufacture people? Produce people.
Didn't Hitler try it in his freedom fund?
Yeah.
What did you say?
Hitler tried it in his breeding farms.
Blonde hair, blue-eyed Germans.
Yeah. But now he's talking about... Okay, that's part of it. That's what's called eugenics. Okay? But in terms of just the teaching, after they're born, what you tell them, and can you actually produce? And is it possible that someone might want to produce urban blockheads? Trousered apes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Why?
So more attrition.
Huh?
So they can control them.
Feels
more.
Color roll.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's more efficient.
Can be more efficient. In terms of not
more
thinking.
Orderly.
Thinking about it. Yeah. Not thinking about things. The differences between us, and he says the differences between G&T and us, which he means himself and all those who are going to be agreeing with him, may go all the way down. They may really hold that the ordinary human feelings about the past or animals or large waterfalls are contrary to reason and contemptible and ought to be eradicated, wiped out. Okay? They may be intending to make a clean sweep of traditional values and to start with a new set. That position will be discussed later. If it is the position which G&T are holding, I must for the moment content myself with pointing out that it is a philosophical and not a literary position. See, again, they're being paid to teach literature and they're doing philosophy. And they don't know they're doing philosophy, and so they're not giving theories, they're giving assumptions, as if it were true, to people who aren't ready, capable of questioning them. In filling their book with this philosophical position, without telling anybody that it's a philosophical position, they have been unjust to the parent or headmaster who buys it and who has got the work of amateur philosophers where he expected the work of professional grammarians. A man would be annoyed if his son returned from the dentist with his teeth untouched and his head filled with the dentist obiter dicta, sickeningly obvious facts on bimetallism or the Baconian theory. Sickeningly obvious facts. And then he says again, I doubt if they are really... I doubt whether they are really planned under the cover of teaching English to propagate their philosophy. And then we'll continue there tomorrow. One thing. If they are, as he says, they may be, but then he says he doesn't really think they are. But if they are trying to eradicate these feelings and to make a clean sweep of traditional values and so forth, G&T See, teaching is pulling teeth, not filling cavities. You know, pulling teeth, got a problem, pull it. The analogy that, well, let me, I'll go over that tomorrow. Okay, Saturday. Saturday, is it 9:30? 9:30? A little bit later.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah.
Is it heritage, the word that implies that you, being human is learned? Is that the word in that sentence that implies the learning?
Well, I think it's the whole thing. It's another little portion has been taken away before they were old enough to understand.
Because then it doesn't seem so much like it's something that they learn.
Human heritage, that which is, you know, has been human. Another thing, part of what it has been to be human is taken away from them.
So it means, it sounds like it's stolen from them, not something that they had that was taken, not something that they didn't have yet and they never got a chance to have. It sounds like something that was in them, they just hadn't, it was taken from them.
Okay, it was taken from them.
Rather
they've
than
been
something that was out there that they had to come to a point where they could learn or pick up.
Yeah. Okay. I think in the case, okay, it's a little different. He comes back on that, talking about that. They have been in, I guess he would say, they have been in the process of learning something, and now G&T turn it around. And they say, oh, don't learn that.
Yeah. But he uses the word understand.
Yeah.
So it's, which is, it's not the equivalent to learning, so it's...
Yeah, well,
I see
it,
what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Say it for me.
No, but you're saying it sounds like
it's something inside of them that they have to come to
realize.
That they have to realize within themselves.
Yeah.
Maybe. Which maybe is the same as learning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, if learning is a process of discovery, then it is. But if learning is just bringing in facts from outside,
I think, okay, what Lewis is going to say, I'll just repeat what he said, that a person, as he, you know, has been in the process of learning things, certain things, about what it is to be human, human heritage, those things that are human, so forth. At this point, it's taken away from them. They don't understand that, you know, they really can't understand what happened to them. They can't understand what they lost yet. So far, all they think that they're doing is growing up. See?
Okay.
They're growing up. But what they're doing is become knowing, a knowing human being. And what Lewis is implying is that they're becoming less human unless somebody comes in. And since they don't know what they're going to be missing, they're not going to be able to seek other opinions, you know,
okay.
And so forth.
Becoming less human is different than not becoming human.
Become less human.
You said they're becoming less human. And if being human is something that you learn, you know, that's a different thing. Becoming more human, becoming less human.
Well, they're taking the possibility of their development away. They have been learning what it is to be human. And G&T take the possibility to continue that away. They take a possibility away.
They also take what they did learn away.
Well, they make them look on what they on their past as contemptible.
Yeah.
When they felt that way. And they feel embarrassed and now they want to be a real knowing fellow. And usually, you know, when you when you discover something, you know. You know what you do. If you think that's so, then if you see a guy 6 months younger than you are who's doing that, you know how you are on him. You know? Ooh. You know, you just really lay into him. Usually when we make a new discovery, we beat everybody's head, you know, who hasn't made it yet. We just pour the scorn on them. That's natural. But it's not human. Lewis would say. Okay, tomorrow morning, okay? Where are we? Okay. Yep, 23. But I doubt whether G&T have really planned, under cover of teaching English, to propagate their philosophy. I think they have slipped into it for the following reasons. In the first place, literary criticism is difficult, and what they actually do is very much easier. To explain why a bad treatment of some basic human emotion is bad literature is, if we exclude all question-begging attacks on the emotion itself, a very hard thing to do. Now, why does he say question-begging? Question-begging attack on the emotion. It's question-begging because the question is, what? It's question begging. Because the question is what?
Asking for another question.
Yeah, question begging means the real question is one thing, and you put another question in, and you answer that question, and you think you've met the first question. Okay? Okay, so what is the real question that G&T should be addressing? We talked this through today.
Why a certain piece of writing is bad?
Yeah.
What makes a certain piece of writing bad?
And it was specifically, what kind of a piece of writing? Piece of writing that deals with what?
Emotions.
Basic human emotion, yeah. Okay. They say the real question is, why is the ad a bad treatment of basic human emotion? And as a bad treatment of basic human emotion, it is bad literature. That's the question that G&T should have dealt with. It's a hard question to answer. Okay? The explanation should involve how style is a criterion of value. Okay? Among other things. Alright? But G&T instead questioned the emotional response itself. They changed the question and questioned the emotional response itself and its validity. And by doing that, they changed what was a literary question to a what? What kind of a question? They changed a literary question to a philosophical question, which is not their business. Okay? Which is not their business. And since they have already denied the predicate of value, that predicate of value says anything about the thing, then they have left the thing alone by itself out there, of just a mere fact. Okay? Gallons of salt water, or millions of gallons of salt water is what the sea is. Huh?
Cold salt water.
Yeah, millions of gallons of cold salt water. And then what do? Their job of teaching literature goes about showing that sea is millions of gallons of cold salt water, and they think they've done their job. They haven't taught anything about literature, but they thought they did, so they didn't feel like they had to ask philosophical questions. And so they weren't as careful as they should have been. How do these come off?
They might just unhook in back.
Yeah, I'll blind you here. Is that reducing enough? Huh? You got shades too.
It goes away really fast.
Yeah.
It moves so fast.
It's going to give us a warm glow to the room.
Oh, that color of wall is pretty visible.
Huh? Mm-hmm. Is this getting any glow? Okay. So, that's essentially what they did as a teaching question. Now, I want to give you something before we go on, and then well, let's see. Should I do it now or later? No, I should do that later. Okay. But one thing, I don't know, just to get clear on value predicates, I don't know if you can see this. This little thing, X is sublime. X is sublime. Okay? You can't see it all. X is sublime. Waterfall is sublime. The is indicates a predicate's going to follow. The waterfall is sublime. Sublime is a value. Okay? The value predicate. It's a value predicate. It's one of the value predicates of, say, aesthetics. Okay, what is beautiful? Waterfalls are beautiful. Okay, it's a value predicate over there. Now, what G and T are saying is that there is no connection between the fact and the emotional response to it. Okay? You've got a fact over here by itself, and you've got this emotion over here by itself. Okay? He splits those. And they says there really isn't a relationship, a proper relationship between those two things. Okay? Is that what they say? Okay. Now, those are value predicates of aesthetics. Now, there are other value predicates. What are those? That is a good ethics. Is that it? Value predicates of ethics. Okay? That act is good. Right. Okay? Nothing that G and T did kept the student from saying that there isn't the same non-relationship, no relationship possible between actions and the value predicates of ethics. Okay? So you've got the action over here, you've got the sentiment that it's just or unjust over here, but they don't meet. Okay? Now once you separate these things, is a fact logical? Is this logical?
How can it be?
Can't be. There's no judgment. It's just outside of logic, isn't it? Okay? Can an emotion by itself be logical? Okay? This waterfall is illogical. This feeling is illogical. And I have arrived at that position logically, say, okay? I've arrived at that position logically, and what have I done? I've used logic to
throw away logic.
Using reason, I've wiped out reason. Okay? And I end up living in a world where everything is separated. Right? There's the feeling over here, and there's the fact over here, and never the between shall meet. Okay? Yeah.
Well, then they couldn't agree with the other guy then either. I mean, the waterfall is pretty. I mean, that's two different things.
They wouldn't agree with him either. No, but pretty, you can be argued that pretty is more like the grass is green. No, pretty, he couldn't do that either.
That's cool, or just that, what this is talking about is what they said.
Yeah.
About, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
How do they, you say, how they use logic to get rid of logic?
Okay, they reason that They use logical methods, argument, right, to show that there isn't, that neither facts nor emotions are logical. So nothing is. There's a good statement on proof. Let me check here. That I copied down from somewhere that does a good job, a better job than I can do on it. Okay. G&T. Well, this is, I don't know if this is going to be. Well, I'll read it. I'll read it again later. All value judgments is something that G&T's position. All value judgments are subjective and dependent on the accidental factors such as mood and occasion, and that there is no more accurate procedure than this. Okay? There is really no such thing as a yardstick by which to measure a waterfall or anything else. Such response as one gives is simply relative to the person and the occasion. Now, the doctrine of objective value, which we're going to talk about now, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others really false, to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we really are. Okay. When Lewis measures his attitude by the objective value rather than by a psychological response according to the mood and occasion, he is able to recognize it as a defect and to acknowledge that life still demands of him a certain response whether he makes it or not. Attitudes can be judged reasonable or unreasonable as they conform or fail to conform to reason. He says those who debunk values practice better than they preach. They speak as if there is at least one value independent of mood and occasion, or they wouldn't write the book. Reason, thus, is used to deny reason, and proof is used to prove that proof is chimerical? Anyway, it's just, proof is, an illusion. Okay. Proof is used to prove that proof is an illusion. All arguments denying the validity of thought, but then he criticizes them. That he's talking about something else. The one thing Lewis is going to be talking about now is that something comes in besides he will say that the emotion in itself is illogical, it's outside of logic, but he says the emotion in relationship to a thing can be what? What's the word he uses? Logical? No. Can be reasonable, doesn't he? Says it can be reasonable. It can be unreasonable to have a different kind of response to something. But it's reasonable not because it's logical, but for some other reason, but for reference to something else. Okay. Now we've, in a sense, we've said a little bit about everything that we're going to be talking about in the rest of the chapter, I think. Because he goes on and then clarifies all those points. He says, to debunk the emotion on the basis of commonplace rationalism and ask yourself, what is commonplace rationalism? What is it like? Okay, commonplace rationalism, like a term. What does it mean? Is within almost anyone's capacity. In the second place, I think G&T may have honestly misunderstood the pressing educational need of the moment. They see the world around them swayed by emotional propaganda. By emotional propaganda. They have learned from tradition that youth is sentimental. And they conclude that the best thing they can do is fortify the minds of the young people against emotion. That's the Spock kind of thing. My own experience as a teacher tells an opposite tale. For every one pupil who needs to be guarded from a weak excess of sensibility, there are three who need to be awakened from the cold slumber of cold vulgarity. Yep. The task of the modern educator is not to cut down jungles, but to irrigate deserts. The right defense against false sentiments is to inculcate just sentiments. By starving the sensibility of our pupils, we only make them easier prey for the propagandist when he comes. For famished nature will be avenged, and a hard heart is no infallible protection against a soft head. And you've heard that in the lifestyle brochure. I quote this whole thing in the lifestyle brochure. Now, they see a certain need. They see a certain need and they go about filling it, and they're cutting off the capacity for sentiment at all, is what Lewis is saying. Again, you can, so okay, now I've armed you so that you can resist advertisements. You know, resist advertisements, and that's a good, but in the same, the way G&T did it, you are also made insensible to literature and eventually ethics, you would say. That one thing for every pupil who needs, down to the soft head, what do you have there? Anything to say? One thing is sentiments. Sentiments. That's a term to fill out too during the rest of this chapter, and actually the whole book. What is it? What are sentiments? That's a question. Okay. What could he mean there? Easily affected by emotion. They get drawn into a single emotion easily, where one emotion takes over. Okay. One definition of what is sentimental in literature is that whenever you have a single emotional response to a piece of literature, that's a sentimental piece of literature. And you have a single emotional response. I use that in the distinction of Rod McEwen poetry. You have a single emotional response to it. It's sentimental poetry. I think many in poetry you have a difficulty too, because many poets see that they don't want to be sentimental. It's very much like what's happening here. They don't want to be sentimental, and so they in throwing out sentimentality, they throw out sentiment too, and they become ironic. They refuse to become, to have a real emotional connection with what they're talking about. They're going to keep a distance on what they're talking about. And that's a problem. And I've said that in my, it's in my master's examination, Master of Fine Arts examination, was that the risk to run is the risk of sentimentality. That a good poem gets right up to the edge of sentimentality but doesn't go over. Doesn't go over the edge. So always the piece of literature, the poem, would cause a person to have a more than a single emotional response. You'll have at least a double emotional response to a particular piece of poetry. Because reality is like that. We don't just love. We don't just hate. We love and hate. And we aren't just attracted to. We aren't just repelled from. There's a little of both. Okay? And a sentimental response is an oversimplified emotional response to something. an oversimplified emotional response to something, if you can say that. And youth, then he would say, youth is tends to oversimplify, to have the single emotional response, and everything gives way to that. And I think he can, I think that is a supportable thing in experience. Okay. I mean, I think in terms of my own adolescence, and when I loved, I loved, and when I hated, and there was never any confusion. You know, there was never any more complexity. There's one thing at a time. And then as you start to see more a mixing, you have numerous emotional responses to the same thing that happens. Does that make any sense? Yes. And then he does say, from tradition, they have learned from tradition that youth is sentimental. And tradition there, I think he's going to mean the Tao. They've learned from the Tao that youth is sentimental. But they conclude that the best thing that they can do is to fortify minds of young people against emotion. And then they destroy a capacity to respond to propaganda, okay, but also to basic human emotions or things that human beings have for a long time found great joy in responding mostly to in meaning. Now he says, by starving the sensibility of our pupils, we only make them easier prey to the propagandist when he comes. What does that imply?
That we need to be filled.
We have a need for this kind of response to things. Okay? But now he said that that G and T are going to try to take away fortify the minds of young people against emotion. Does he say it's going to really work?
Mm-hmm.
No. Because we do need that kind of response. And then he says the irony or the black humor of this thing is that you arm the people against they no longer, well, in trying to deal with a propagandist, they make the student who is subject more than anything to the propagandist, because he's going to be starved for that sort of, for that emotional response to something. And finally that is going to express it, but that need is going to, well, a propagandist is always going to be offering to that oversimplification, emotional response. And finally the guy goes, gets swallowed up by propaganda. And that's the irony of their approach, because that emotional, that sentiment that the waterfall is sublime, is not as, doesn't satisfy the needs quite so readily. it's one sentiment that feels good, but it isn't something that is going to be make you think that you're filled up. The need has been satisfied. Okay. The right defense against false sentiments is to inculcate just sentiments. And I want just sentiments, false sentiments. Then those two words, we're going to try to figure out what he means by those two words as we go along. There's a profounder reason for the procedure that G&T adopt. They may be perfectly ready to admit that a good education should build some sentiments while destroying others. They may endeavor to do so, but it is impossible that they should succeed. Do what they will, it is the debunking side of their work, and this side alone which will really tell on the students. In order to grasp this necessity clearly, I must digress for a moment to show what may be called the educational predicament of G&T is different from that of all their predecessors. Now, that's a quiet little line, but what is he saying? The educational predicament of G&T is different from all their predecessors. That goes back 10,000 years, okay, all. It's a different thing they're trying to do. Different problem that they have, educational problem that they have. That this is the first century we really had that educational problem. We're in a new time.
I don't understand the part about the do what they will, it isn't the funky side of the world.
Which will really tell.
Yeah.
Okay, they may endeavor to keep some values. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the weapon they use to debunk some values is as effective on all values.
Okay.
And it's going to wipe out everything. Okay? That's what Lewis is saying, and he'll show how that works. Now, one thing to ask, too, is what have we discovered to make this this next paragraph seem no longer the case? What is the evidence? He's saying up to now, up to this point in history, it's gone one way and now it's going another. Now, what have we discovered to make the educational situation of the last 10,000 years be no longer important, the important thing to do, but that we must do something else? What have we discovered to make holding that there is such a thing as objective value no longer meaningful to us? And what evidence is given? Until quite modern times, all teachers and even all men believed the universe to be such that certain emotional reactions on our part could be either congruous or incongruous to it, or believed in fact that objects did not merely receive but could merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence or contempt. Okay, this is an explanation of ordinate love again, remember, from yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
These are some other words to go with ordinate. Congruous. Inordinate, incongruous. That objects did not merely receive, but could merit. And G&T were saying a waterfall can receive that, but it doesn't merit it. There's nothing about the waterfall that it causes that response to be anything meaningful or congruous. Our things can merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence or our contempt. The reason why Coleridge agreed with the tourist who called this cataract sublime and disagreed with the one who called it pretty was, of course, that he believed inanimate nature to be such that certain responses could be more just or ordinate or appropriate to it than others. And he believed correctly that the tourists thought the same. The man who called the cataract sublime was not intending simply to describe his own emotions about it. He was also claiming that the object was one which merited those emotions. But for this claim there would be nothing to agree or disagree about. To disagree with "this is pretty," if those words simply describe the lady's feelings, would be absurd. Now, I don't quite understand this next example. If she had said, "I feel sick," Coleridge would hardly have replied, "No, I feel quite well." I don't make a connection on that one there.
Well, is that the same as the business about saying that you are contemptible?
You are sick, and then I would say, which means I feel sick.
Sure.
So
it's like that one is a contemptible.
Yeah, the opposite.
Your feelings are contemptible, my feelings.
Yeah, both people thought they were talking about the waterfall, not about themselves. And they disagreed with each other. But they disagreed with the disagreement was about the waterfall. Is that how it went? And now here in this example of them being sick, they disagree with each other, but they're not talking about themselves. No, that doesn't make sense.
It's on 15. It says, as he extends that idea, says, you are contemptible, means I have contemptible feelings, and your feelings are contemptible, means my feelings are contemptible. Right? And so, if she says, I feel sick.
To disagree with, this is pretty, if those words simply describe the lady's feelings, would be as absurd as the following, which is clearly absurd. Okay, so he's extended the logic. Okay, and Coleridge wouldn't have done that.
But... would G&T have?
Yeah.
He's implying that they wouldn't.
Well, G&T didn't know what they were saying.
Right.
G&T
didn't
realize what they were saying.
But he's implying that the extension of G&T's idea
would have done
that,
it.
Which is absurd.
Yeah. Yeah. Which
is.
Is
that what G&T would have said? If one said, I feel sick, the other would have said, no, I feel well.
No, they
wouldn't have said it, but
idea.
Yeah. The extension of the logic of the statement that they did make would make that.
You follow it.
Yeah.
Then you get there.
Okay. In other words, if the feelings were dealing with only the person, it would be absurd to contradict.
Right.
Your feelings are your feelings. That's that. I mean, you can't contradict your feelings. But your response to the waterfall, you know, can be. You know, that can be, you know, you can kind of, that's not the proper response to the waterfall. Now, what is it? How is the proper response measured? He goes on and talks about that. Emphasize that merited the response, okay? Merited the response. We're going to try to see how that works. When Shelley, having compared the human sensibility to an Aeolian lyre, goes on to add that it differs from a lyre in having a power of internal adjustment whereby it can accommodate its chords to the motions of that which strikes them. He is assuming the same belief. That clear?
No. I just lost.
Not to me either. When Shelley, having compared the human sensibility to a guitar, goes on to add that it differs from a guitar in having a power of internal adjustment whereby it can accommodate its chords to the motion of that which strikes them.